Welcome to Big Blue Kickoff Live right here on Giants.com. John Schmelk, Paul Dottino with you, 201-939-4513. Want to remind you guys that are watching on Giants.com that this is audio only. In fact, we are in a paint fume infested room right now. They just finished painting in here. But we're doing the show. As I said, it's audio only. So we are with you right here on Giants.com. And a couple things to touch on, Paul. We'll be joined by somebody to preview the Giants and Rams a little bit later on in the show. But, of course, the Giants announcing three new members of their Ring of Honor, and these are three contemporary members that Giant fans of even young ages will be very familiar with. We'll start with the guy who arrived here first. That was Ernie Accorsi, who was a longtime general manager of the Giants, played a role in bringing in Tom Coughlin, drafted Eli Manning. So, yeah, a pretty big deal. then Tom Coughlin, the man that he helped hire, obviously, two Super Bowl championships, perhaps the best coach in Giants history right there with Bill Parcells. He's going up there, wasting no time. So anybody that thought there was a lot of bad blood between Coach Coughlin and the organization, I think this pretty much shows that there's not. And then finally, Justin Tuck heading into the Ring of Honor as well. Well-deserved, played great in two Super Bowls, two-time Super Bowl champion, all-around good guy, great leader. And those are the three guys that will be heading in Monday night against the Cincinnati Bengals in, I believe, beginning of November, if I'm not
14th.
Mistaken. November 14th. Thank you. And that's what the Ring of Honor this year will look like for Big Blue.
You know, John, I think it's really cool. We've got now Tuck and OC and Michael Strahan. You know, the three guys who really, I mean, I know it's a front four. I get that. But those three guys were really the key members.
Where's Fred Robbins?
Fred Robbins, heck of a player.
He's not of that caliber. Of course not. I'm joking.
Obviously. The other three all went to Pro Bowls
right.
as members of the Giants Super Bowl championship
Correct.
Defensive line.
And then JPP kind of got into the mix in 2011.
He was right. on the back end of that.
Yes.
He only got to be in one of the Super Bowls.
He was with OC and Tuck in 2011. And Strahan was only in one also in 2007.
That's correct. That is correct.
Yeah, so JPP kind of took Strahan's spot.
Boy, am I getting old, John. Michael Strahan's been out of this game for almost 10 years now.
Yeah, remember, 07 was his last year. Yeah. So he didn't play in 08, 09, 10 either.
Is that amazing?
Know? It's crazy, right?
How'd that happen?
Wow. Yeah, it's crazy.
Time is really flying by. But in any event, you get what I'm saying. The Pro Bowl, Super Bowl linemen. And they're all together again now with this move.
And you have the two guys that were really, you know, the architects of the 2007 Super Bowl. Jerry Reese was your general manager, but Ernie Accorsi obviously put a lot of that talent in place. And then a lot of those players that Ernie brought in were left in 2011. But, of course, Jerry Reese's fingerprints were well on that 2011 team with, you know, Victor Cruz and Akeem Nicks and Jason Pierre-Paul. But 07, you know, was a lot of Ernie's guys were still on that team when the Giants won the Super Bowl that year.
I will recall actually running into Ernie Accorsi in the locker room after the Giants won that playoff game in Green Bay at the end of the 2007 season. And, you know, he was just so proud of Eli Manning because, after all, as you said, Eli was his doing. He was the guy who was hell-bent on, I'm getting Eli Manning. He's the franchise quarterback who's going to bring us to the promised land, and I'm not going to be deterred.
And I'll tell you what, 4 years after that trade was made, there were a lot of people that really thought the Giants had made a mistake.
And I guess they didn't.
No. And we'll talk more about this. You can give us a call. Get on the line. We'll, of course, take your calls and talk about anything you want to talk about, including the Ring of Honor, at 201-939-4513. It's all brought to you by DraftKings. But now we will be joined on the phone as we continue our preview series, previewing the Giants' opponents as we approach training camp. All the way from Los Angeles, getting up a little bit early for us today. We appreciate it. Vincent Bonsignor from the LA Daily News. Vincent, you got John Schmelk and Paul Dottino here in New Jersey. How are you this morning?
I'm doing good, and I got to say, two Super Bowls later, I kind of think that was a good trade.
I'll tell you what, Vincent, you would not believe the calls in the talk radio. The year the Giants won in 2007, after Week 10, the Giants lost to the Minnesota Vikings. Eli Manning threw five interceptions in that game, if I'm not mistaken.
Remember Darren Sharper?
Darren Sharper had two of them, one for a touchdown, and there was literally a line of people outside the stadium giving up on Eli Manning. So it shows, and I guess it's going to be a good lesson for Rams fans here as they have a little patience with their rookie quarterback out there in Jared Goff to make sure they give him the time necessary to become the quarterback they want him to be.
Well, there's no question about that, but let's face it, considering the cost that it required to move up from 15 to 1 to get Jared Goff in the draft. I mean, it's five draft picks, a number one, two number twos this year, a number one next year, a third-round pick next year as well. It was a steep price to do something that was unprecedented to move that high. And anyone that's been watching the Rams the last couple of years understands this is a good team. They just need a quarterback that's going to be able to either just manage the game and make a play here and there to keep a drive alive, to convert a touchdown rather than a field goal in the red zone. And if he can be that guy, if Goff can be that guy, this team has a chance to, you know, turn a 7-9 into a 9-7. But it is going to take patience because, judging by OTAs, he's got a ways to go. And that's, you know, the standard for any young quarterback. But they need him to be good as soon as possible.
Well, let me ask you this, Vincent. Before we get to the X's and O's of some of what the Rams have done during the offseason, the Giants will be playing them at the end of October on the 29th in London. It will be a Rams home game, but we're not coming out to the West Coast to see you guys. We're going the other way, across the Atlantic Ocean, to play that game in England. So let me first ask you a two-part question, really. One, what has the response been out in Los Angeles for the Rams coming back in this second stint on the West Coast? And two, what is the feeling about the team in their first year coming back, actually giving up a home game and running in the other direction?
Well, hopefully, I think it's October 23rd. I just booked my flight, so I want to make sure. It's not the 29th.
You're right. It is the 23rd. I did say the 29th. The 23rd. It is the 23rd. You're right.
trying to kill me out here on the West Coast.
Sorry, brother.
It's a great question. And number one, as far as the fan interest and the excitement, they just sold 70,000 season tickets for this year at the Coliseum, of all places.
Wow.
93-year-old. Venue. It's going to be, you know, old school football, to say the least. But there's plenty more that want tickets. So the excitement is there. There's no doubt about it. This is the Rams back in Los Angeles. And for old-time Rams fans, they understand that it's been since 1979 since they've played in Los Angeles. Before that, I mean, after that, it was in Anaheim, which is, you know, Southern California, but it's not L.A. So
right.
The whole nostalgia aspect, the whole excitement aspect is very much intact. Now, how they feel and Los Angeles feels about the team itself, it's a very interesting question because I've equated it to, you know, 23 years ago, your dad walked out of your life and just, you know, moseyed on down the road, and you kind of wrote him off for good, and he's not coming back and whatever. And then all of a sudden he shows back up at your doorstep, and you want to love him, you want to embrace him, but it's a little awkward trying to figure out where they fit into the whole scheme of things. You've got the Lakers, you've got USC football, you've got the Dodgers, obviously. So there's a lot to be interested in here, you know, in Los Angeles sports. So getting to know the team, understanding who they are, and living and dying with it on a weekly basis, I think that's going to be a bit of a process. But no doubt about it, fans want to embrace them as the 70,000 that gobbled up season tickets like that in an instant shows. But you know, the rabid fan living and dying with the team as they do in New York with the Giants. It'll be interesting to see how long that takes before it gets to that point.
We're joined by Vincent Bonsignor, covers the L.A. Rams for the L.A. Daily News. I know I'm going to screw that up at least a few times this year and call them the St. Louis Rams. Vincent, I'm not sure how much this interests fans, but it certainly does me, someone that's worked for an organization now for, you know, almost 10 years. What's the transition been like for the Rams themselves, getting the front office over there, getting their practice facility in place, getting their staff in place, housing, you know, all that logistical stuff that I got to imagine is a nightmare for a team taking its entire operation and taking it across half the country. What's that process been like for the Rams?
Fascinating, to say the least. And you know, all throughout last year during the process of getting them from St. Louis to Los Angeles, and by that I mean the vote with the NFL, you know, we had the Chargers and Raiders that were vying for a spot in Carson, about 15 miles away from Inglewood, which is where the Rams will ultimately be. But behind the scenes, they were already, you know, getting boots on the ground here in Los Angeles just in case the vote went their way. So it's been a process that's been over a year in the making. But, you know, you are talking about not just the players themselves. You know, let's face it, they make enough money, they'll be fine. They've got, real estate agents knocking on their door trying to sell them houses or rent them houses in the L.A. area. Although I'll say, even the players were a little bit surprised by the difference between St. Louis prices and Los Angeles prices. So they were in for a rude awakening. But
yeah. Vincent, come on, you don't have a couple extra condos to rent them?
Exactly. You know, it was funny. I was talking to Greg Robinson, one of their players, and he was talking about how he was this close to renting a house, and somebody came in and gobbled it up. This what you know, and these are like $2 million, $3 million homes that, as you guys know, back east in your area, neck of the woods, that's not a lot of money for people that live out here. So, you know, back in St. Louis, you had your pick of the litter on some of the great homes that are there. But here, there's going to be some competition. But even more than the players, it's the staff members. You know, you've got about 150 staff members that made the trip from St. Louis. So them finding homes and getting situated while you're still planning for a football season. There's work to be done. There's tickets to be sold. There's media books to put out. There's all of that stuff that goes on behind the scenes that they had to do on the move. And even just their off season, they had to practice for the OTAs in Oxnard, which is in Ventura County. Now they're going to go to Irvine, which is in Orange County, for training camp. Then it's back to Ventura County in Thousand Oaks for their seasonal headquarters.
Wow.
So this is mass transition that they're undergoing. And I guess the key to all of it is, how will that reflect in how they play this year? And that's the question that we're not going to get answers to until we see them in London against the Giants and throughout the rest of the regular season.
When you look at the Rams, the first thing that sticks out, obviously, is Todd Gurley, because the guy's a beast. Let's face it. He's one of the new generation running backs in this league who appears to be a bell cow. He's not one of those guys who really wants to share a lot of carries. Does it really start and live and die, basically, the Rams' fortunes with Todd Gurley and what he does this year on his shoulders?
Without a doubt, and that's going to help, you know, whether it's Jared Goff or Case Keenum. I know Rams fans don't want anything. I mean, they like Case Keenum, but they want it to be Jared Goff. But whoever the quarterback is going to be able to lean heavily on Todd Gurley. And the scary thing for the rest of the NFL is, this time last year, he wasn't even cleared to begin football activity.
Yeah.
He was still rehabilitating
from
the knee injury he suffered at Georgia. Well, this offseason, it's been all about football, to the point where he lost 15 pounds. We asked him, how'd you do that? Because I have no idea. You know, I just fell off. But he looks fantastic. And he looked, I know it was in shorts and shoulder pads and a helmet in OTAs, but he looked ridiculous in OTAs. This guy is, barring any kind of an injury, he's not only, you know, has a chance to, I think, lead the league in rushing, but because of their quarterback situation, because of Coach Jeff Fisher's, you know, he likes to run the ball, and Todd's ability to be able to, like you said, be a guy that carries it 25, 30 times a game, he's in line for a breakthrough year, and he is, like you said, the kind of guy that has the ability and the physical endurance to be able to carry the ball that many times.
Losing 15 pounds, though, Vincent, I have to ask you, aren't you the least bit curious as to, will that affect some of his power and some of his durability? Because, you know, he was a rock-solid specimen.
Yeah, no, and it wasn't like he lost fat. You know, it was like the good kind of weight, when you're building your muscles up and that type of thing. It wasn't bad by any stretch of the imagination, and he looks just chiseled. And obviously I was in Los Angeles, he was in St. Louis last year. I was able to see him up close and personal, maybe a couple of times, but it sure doesn't look like it was a bad thing. He looks to be in just tremendous shape right now.
You know, Vincent, I hope you understand where I'm coming from with this question. We talked about the quarterback situation, Goff obviously coming along slowly, as all rookies do in OTAs. But over the past few years, the Rams have been searching for a quarterback. And I feel like in the same way, they've almost been searching for weapons for that quarterback, too. You guys already mentioned Todd Gurley, but in terms of the players the quarterback has to throw the football to, has it been more a case of the Rams' quarterback situation holding back a class of young wide receivers that could be better if they had a better quarterback? Or is the Rams' wide receiver core not where it needs to be, and that's maybe hurt the development of the quarterbacks over the past few years? How do they view this receiving core, Tavon Austin, Kenny Britt, Brian Quick, and then a bunch of young guys?
Well, I'd like to be as sort of optimistic as you are to hope that, you know, it was the quarterback that was holding back the wide receivers. I just don't think that that's the case. I think that
that's why I asked.
You know, and unfortunately, in having to, you know, put as much to put as many draft picks into acquiring Jared Goff, they obviously couldn't really address their wide receiver position during the draft. Yes, they did draft Farrell Cooper from South Carolina, who looks pretty good, I have to admit. Although he's more of a Tavon Austin type of a guy,
right.
You know, screens, slant patterns, passes, maybe in the run game. They don't have that big, you know, down the field threat, number one type receiver that you have to have, that a good quarterback needs, you know, to excel. So that's something that they're going to have to, you know, hope somebody emerges. They did, you know, take a flyer on Duke Williams from Auburn a couple of years ago. He was considered, you know, by a lot of draft analysts as the best wide receiver in the country. Unfortunately for him, he got kicked off the team at Auburn last year and wasn't able to show what he was all about. And as a result, his draft status, you know, plummeted, and the Rams were able to get him as a free agent. He's a big 6'3", 220-pound fast guy, but he's got off-field issues. And until he fixes those, and hopefully he has, we don't know exactly what he's capable of doing. But other than that, there really isn't anyone on that roster that you can definitively say, this is the guy that's going to be that guy. And it's going to be an issue for a little while longer. They're going to have to figure out a way to get somebody that can do that for them.
One more quickie on the offense from me, Vince. And the only thing that helps a quarterback more than really good wide receivers is a really good offensive line. And I want to focus in on the group, and specifically Greg Robinson, who was, I think, a top three pick guy, if I remember right, 2 years ago. And, you know, people talked about in that draft that, you know, the best physical upside of any offensive lineman in the draft. But by all accounts, he's really struggled his first 2 years in the league. What's their progress report on whether or not they think he can really develop into that franchise left tackle in year number three for him?
Well, and I talked to Greg about this, and he knows, there's nobody that knows more than he does, that this is the biggest year of his career, because you're right. He hasn't lived up to the billing. He was a top two pick. He was the second pick in the draft a couple of years ago out of Auburn, and it was supposed to be that cornerstone franchise left tackle that you could rely on for the next 15 years. Well, he certainly hasn't been that in his first 2 years, and he needs to be that for the Rams, again, to take a step forward. He, you know, over the last five games last year, he actually kind of put it together, and he probably had his best stretch of his career. When I talked to him, he said that it coincided with him feeling healthy. He had a foot injury for most of last year that really held him back. He feels like he's completely healthy. He's motivated, obviously, because this is a big year for him in his long-range future, contract-wise and all the other elements that go along with it. But he needs to be that guy, and he hasn't been. And until he is, that's a huge question mark. And their offensive line, I mean, they've put premium picks into that unit between 2014 and 2015 after pretty much just paying lip service to it the years before that. So theoretically, the talent is there because they've drafted guys with premium picks to fix it. Now it's just a matter of them putting it together. They've been, you know, had some injury issues last year. A lot of guys played that. You can look at that two ways. One way to look at it is a bunch of guys got up to speed NFL, you know, a bunch of young players got up to speed NFL-wise. Now, whether they're good or what the Rams need them to be, that still remains to be seen. And
right. And
unless that happens, you know, that offense is still going to struggle, even with Jared Goff or whoever it is at quarterback playing better.
You know, you're talking about premium picks. In 11, 12, 13, and 14, they used a first-round pick on a guy who needed to start on defense. Everybody knows how great Aaron Donald is. Everybody knows that Ogletree was a franchise guy coming out. But what about the other parts that have to fit in around them? Because, Vincent, I'm looking at that depth chart, and I'm saying to myself, I think it's top-heavy. I think there's some really good guys here, but I'm not so sure that there's enough depth here to make it a, quote, good defense.
Well, it's funny because I was just doing a roster breakdown, and I agree with you in some cases, but disagree with you in a couple. I think the defensive line, it depends on a couple of guys. Dominic Easley, guys that they've picked up via free agency, not as starters, but as what you like, exactly what you said, depth-wise. Coples, the former Jet, coming in here. If he could just be half of what he was or somewhat of what he was as a starter in reserve, then that's going to help him because their starting defensive line is fantastic,
yeah.
Starting with Aaron Donald and Robert Quinn and on and on. Linebacker-wise, I don't see anyone in reserve. That's the problem that I see with their linebackers. You've got Ogletree, you've got Mark Barron, who is a stud, and you've got Akeem Ayers, who is good enough. But behind them, a lot of question marks. Defensive backs, well, we already know Janoris Jenkins is with you guys now with the Giants. That hurt, obviously. Rodney McLeod, the safety, starting safety, is in Philadelphia. So they have to figure out two-fourths of their starting defensive backfield. They believe in their ability to develop young talent and to identify young talent. So they're comfortable that E.J. Gaines is going to replace Janoris Jenkins and that somebody among Cody Davis and Maurice Alexander and Christian Bryant can replace Rodney McLeod. But again, that's what they believe is going to happen or what they hope is going to happen, but they still have to go out there and do that. And you're right, depth-wise, aside from the defensive line, I think depth-wise they're going to get tested in the on the defense. But if they, starting-wise, to me anyway, they're a playoff-caliber defense. It's a battle of attrition, as we all know, in a 16-game NFL season. So at some point, guys are going to have to step up in those reserve roles and be productive players, and that's where I have a little bit of concern.
Final question, Vincent, before we let you go, and again, we appreciate your time. The Giants have this game with the Rams in London. The Giants, for example, are going to go out on Thursday. They're not going to make a whole week of this, and some teams have made more of a week of it than others have. How do the Rams plan to handle this road game?
Well, they almost have no choice. They play in Detroit the Sunday before on the 16th, I believe it is. And so rather than go all the way back to California and then all the way to London, they're just going to leave Detroit and go to London. So they'll be there Sunday night, Monday morning in London and make a week out of it. Had they had the bye week or had they been playing on the West Coast the week previous, they would have done what the Giants were going to do. They were going to fly out on Thursday. But because of the logistics of everything, and
that's
another thing, moving from St. Louis to Los Angeles, they got a rude awakening on the travel schedule because it's no longer 2 hours from here to there.
This is true.
Wherever they go. And they go to Tampa. They go to England. They go to Detroit. They go to play the Jets in East Rutherford and New England, to play the Patriots. So that's five long trips. I think they're going to set a record for mileage over the course of a 16-game season. So there are some benefits to coming to L.A. There's no doubt about it. But travel-wise, it's going to be a little bit different than when they were in St. Louis.
Were there any protests, real quick, Vincent, about the game in London starting at 9:30 Eastern, which means it's a 6:30 a.m. start for the folks in L.A.?
You know what? I don't think that word has really gotten out quite as much. People are going to freak out when they see that. But then again, the people that are enjoying the good life on Saturday night, they'll just stumble home and turn on the TV and be able to watch it, 6 o'clock in the morning? So eventually, it's going to dawn on people that that's what's going on. I don't think enough people have actually realized that part of it. They're just happy to have the Rams back. And come October, they'll go, wait a minute, 6:30 in the morning? Are you kidding me? So think about the people in Hawaii who are Rams fans or NFL fans for that matter. So, but they're just going to have to deal with it or DVR it and watch it later or do something, but that is a very, very early start.
Vincent, great stuff. We'll see you across the Atlantic. Enjoy your next week and a half so of freedom until the players show up and all our lives quickly come to an end for the next 5 months.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, first pint is on me in London.
Sounds good, my friend. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
All right, you guys. Take care.
Vincent Bonsignor, and I think I got the good Paisan pronunciation there tonight.
Good job, John.
Vincent Bonsignor from the L.A. Daily News joining us. And, of course, I was going to ask him about Janoris Jenkins, but he wasn't there covering the Rams last year in St. Louis, right. So I didn't think it was worth asking him the question.
You know, I think the 70,000 season tickets that were immediately sold for the old L.A. Coliseum to get this team out there, that was quite startling to
That's
me.
That's impressive.
I had not heard that number, but apparently, these people really want to see this team.
They're excited. Hey, NFL is big business, man. There's a reason every time a big NFL game on, it breaks the new ratings record than it was on the last time. That's why all people say, oh, the NFL, I think it's starting to slowly die off. I mean, really? Look at the ratings, man.
I'll tell you what, though.
Look at the ratings. Look what these networks are paying for game packages.
If you think the stadium in San Diego for the Chargers is antiquated, they're playing in the L.A. Coliseum.
You know what? I'm not sure what's worse, having to go set up in London with, different power and ISDN and in Europe or trying to set up at the L.A. Coliseum. Thank goodness we don't have to deal with Candlestick anymore, though. That place.
That was nasty.
Just to give the fans an idea, and then we'll get to your calls at 201-939-4513. We're all brought to you by DraftKings, of course. As you might imagine, for our radio broadcast, we have a lot of equipment. We have, you know, power strips and power strips. There's a lot of gear. So the boxing candlestick is small. I'd say it was probably about, what, 6-foot by 6-foot box?
I've seen many closets bigger.
Something like that? I would say about 6-foot by 6-foot, right?
Yeah.
6 by 8 foot, maybe something like that. With all that gear we have in there, there was one working outlet. One working outlet. You try putting a radio broadcast on with one working outlet. You had power strips into power strips into power strips. It was a mess.
Or how about the locker room that was so small that you could barely go shoulder to shoulder through it, and then the coach's press conference, the briefing after the game, was in the same locker room where all of us had to get dressed and changed and while the coach was talking.
Which is also a storage area, by the way.
Yes.
Yes.
And oh, by the way, the TV guy who had to do the post-game interviews with the players had to do it outside on a sidewalk, outside of the stadium.
You were outside of the sidewalk?
Yes.
I didn't know that. That's funny.
Yes. And remember the playoff game when it rained?
Yeah.
And I had to get guys to stop for me outside on the sidewalk.
So that's two strikes. One, they got to talk to you. And
yeah.
Two, it's raining.
They were probably happier to get wet.
No question about it. Is Jerome still on the line there, Dave? 201-939-4513. All right, let's get to the calls, folks. It's you, me, old school the rest of the way. Jerome is in Charlotte. Jerome, what's going on?
I was listening to the call. I called yesterday, and after I called, I was listening to the rest of the show, as always. One of the callers was calling about trying to sign Hankins now instead of waiting until next year. And what I was thinking after the show was that JPP and Hankins, and I think one of the linemen's contracts is up, I'm not sure, but between, you know, with that being said, if both have a good year, who would the Giants franchise?
Well, they cannot, I don't believe, franchise JPP again, right? Wasn't that in his one-year deal, if I remember right, or am I wrong about that?
I don't know if he required that stipulation.
I don't remember.
I don't remember either.
Either way, that would be a huge investment, because if you franchise a defensive lineman a second consecutive year, you're looking at about $20 million on the franchise tag. So I doubt that they're going to put a $20 million franchise tag on Jason Pierre-Paul unless he goes out there and has like a 16-17 sack year. And frankly, Hankins has to play better if he wants to be worth as much as the franchise tag is going to be put on him. Is it for are DNs and defensive tackle separated for the franchise tag?
Yes.
It is, right?
Yes.
So the defensive tackle is probably, what, around $10 million for the franchise tag, something like that?
Jeez, I can't or 11, tell you offhand what it is.
I would imagine it's somewhere between 10 and 12. And here's the thing about Hankins, Jerome. You know, he has to play better to earn that franchise tag. And I think that's why getting something done with him long-term before the season starts, you know, probably is not going to happen. Because if you think about it, Hankins is covered off a down year where he was hurt. And 2 years ago, he played extremely well. So he's going to want to get paid based off what he did in the year he got paid, played extremely well. The Giants are going to want to pay him based on last year, which was a down year. So I doubt they'd be able to come to a long-term contract agreement anyway. So I think really Hankins' year this year is huge for him, and it will really dictate what type of contract he can get on the open market.
I will tell you this. Based on the list of current unrestricted free agents that the Giants will have after this season, you've actually just named the guys who are the key guys.
Defensive tackle, by the way, $13.4 million, so it was higher than I thought it
okay.
was. And defensive end would be $15.4
million. Hankins, JPP, John Jerry's currently a starter. If you think he's a key free agent, then you could put him in that group if you like. Larry Donnell is to this point, he's been a starter. I don't know what's going to happen with his injury, and you know, if he's still a starter.
And Victor Cruz under contract, but again, this year they played around with that. We'll see if they end up doing something like that again.
Yeah, I mean,
on the
he's signed
he
for next year,
right.
But the number is rather warped.
Yeah, but remember, they ended up talking to him and got that done this year with him, too. So.
And then Jasper Brinkley, if he turns out to be the starting middle linebacker, then you could say perhaps that he's a key component. But those are the guys who you probably would be most interested in
Pugh,
trying
right?
to retain.
You mentioned Pugh, right?
Pugh is not an unrestricted free agent.
Sure he is.
According to the list I'm looking at.
Right, didn't they give him his fifth year this year, and that would be next year.
So why is he not on the list?
Well, he's up after next year, not after this year. Pugh.
I'm talking about March 2017.
Okay, yeah, Pugh's up in March 2018. That's my mistake.
There
my fault.
Go.
Yep.
So with all the ones you just named, who is more likely to get the tag?
I don't know if anybody's getting that. Honestly, if I had to bet right now, Jerome, I don't think anybody gets the franchise tag next year.
First of all, the Giants don't like to use it. Let's make that very clear. They are not quick to use the franchise tag in this organization. Second of all, it's to their benefit. Let's face it. If they can negotiate a reasonable deal with any of these guys. That's it?
One more question. Yesterday I was talking about the old games, and I was looking at the Super Bowl from 86 and 90.
Yeah.
And Carl Banks, to me, don't get the credit he deserves, because he was a beast in 86, exhausted, running around. Same thing with 90. I never see his name high on the Hall of Fame list, and he won two Super Bowls, same team. I feel him and Phil Simms don't get their credit.
Well, if I may just say this, and both John and I get to pleasure of working with Carl on a weekly basis.
You want to use that word? That's fine.
I will say this about Carl Banks. He was the defensive MVP of Super Bowl 25.
Yes.
Okay?
Yeah.
And he was the defensive. The defensive. You can't neglect what Otis Anderson did, though,
right.
Especially on that record-breaking drive that really was the trademark of the Giants' victory.
Correct.
Right. Well, I'm just saying how, you know, I never, every year, during the Battle of the Hall of Fame, you never see him in the top 20.
Well, Jerome, we'll let you go, but here's
thank you
what
for
I
call.
Thank you. You know what I will say? You have to understand, whether or not it's justified, he played on one of the great linebacking cores in NFL history.
Yeah, LT overshadowed him. Look, it's just...
And Harry Carson.
Yeah, good point. 86.
And, you know, Carl went to one Pro Bowl. And you know what? Hall of Fame voters are going to look at that, and they're going to say, talk all you want about how good he was and how overshadowed he was, but he went to one Pro Bowl, and they're going to hold that against him every time.
And look, he wasn't a guy that got the big sexy sack numbers. That was LT. Carl Banks did all like the by-the-book dirty work and covered up everything to allow LT to be LT. You know, that's what Carl did. He stopped the run. He set the edge. He did all the non-sexy stuff.
Heck of a
and he
stop.
Can cover, too. I mean, the battles between him and Bavaro in practice are legendary. But you don't get a lot of credit for that type of stuff, unfortunately. And, you know, Simms, I think, is closer than Banks is. I don't think anybody would argue that. But I think the problem you get into with Simms is that early in his career, as you well know, Paul, he kind of went back and forth as a starter and not the starter. And, you know, his career ended fairly early because of his injury history, his back. And finally, quarterback numbers from the 80s just don't compare to the quarterback numbers you see now. It was just the way the game was played. I mean, Phil Simms was accurate as hell. He had a shoulder injury, sorry.
Rotator cuff.
Yeah, rotator cuff, my mistake. I know he had other back issues, but the rotator cuff is what eventually took him out. But, you know, you go back then, and Phil Simms had completed what? Like, probably on average for his career, what, like 53% of his passes,
yeah,
give or take?
Maybe 54.
Now, that would be terrible.
Right.
Then
game's changed.
It was good. And it's just the numbers look different.
I want to add this one thing to Jerome, if you're still listening out there. I hope you are. Carl Banks was voted to the all-decade team of the 1980s.
You know what? I didn't know that. Good for him. He earned that.
By the Hall of Fame Selection Committee. So he does have some measure of acknowledgement from the Hall of Fame folks.
Right.
Now, that's not going to get his bust in Canton, but you know what? The all-decade team is an official list that the Hall of Fame puts out, and you can find it on NFL.com, and those list, the guys on that list, they're good.
How many linebackers are on that team? Do you have the full team in front of you?
I have the full team in front of me.
How many linebackers?
I'll tell you who they are.
Do they name backups and starters or just starters?
No, they name backups too.
Okay, so there's what, six linebackers on that team?
They named eight.
Eight, okay.
Singletary, Taylor, Ted Hendricks, Lambert.
Lambert, huh?
Yeah.
He only was in the early 80s, wasn't he? He didn't play much into the late 80s.
Again, he qualified, yeah, and they voted him.
I guess.
John Anderson, Banks, and actually, no, that's it. So one, two, wait a minute. I missed Andre Tippett.
Andre Tippett was
one,
really
two,
good.
Three, four, five, six, seven. They took seven linebackers, and Carl Banks is one of seven.
Where did Anderson play?
Jesus Christ, I don't know. Why don't I know him?
I was honestly, I was embarrassed that I didn't. I mean, granted, I was 81, so in 89, I was only 8 years old. He was a Packer, huh?
And you know what? I don't recollect.
Well,
him
the
at
Packers
all.
Were pretty awful in the '80s.
Yeah,
that's probably why.
Yeah,
Don Majkowski's wasn't getting it.
Six,
the Magic Man.
Seven linebackers on the all-decade team, and Carl's one of them. So. You know what? That's pretty good.
Sims' career passing percentage, by the way, 55.4. So better than I thought. But still, today, you complete 55% of your passes, you're terrible. Then, that was really good because you're throwing it down the field all the time.
You know, the one thing that you know, I appreciate that the caller did, he said he went back, I guess, the last couple of weeks and looked at the old Super Bowls.
By the way, I want to remind folks that are listening or watching that the feed's not broken. This is audio only. So just want to remind people of that, too. They're reconstructing our studio here. It's not done yet. In fact, it just painted today. So we're enjoying the wondrous paint fumes in what was our studio. So hopefully we'll be back video sometime next week. But I just wanted to throw that in there, Paul.
No, that's cool. My only thought was, in terms of the caller going back to watch Super Bowl 21 and Super Bowl 25, I mean, when you look at those teams, John, it's hard to imagine that you'd have any chance because of the salary cap and free agency and way things work of putting together those kinds of teams again. You're talking about those two Giants teams. I think the 86 team had like nine Pro Bowlers on it.
Well, that's why to me, Paul, the last real – and again, the Patriots in 2007, I think, are an exception to the rule because they were just exceptional in the salary cap era, which doesn't happen very often.
Yes.
They were phenomenal. So take them out of the equation. But – to me, the last really great Super Bowl teams that you had were the early 90 Cowboys. Because once you got past that team,
no question,
you were into free agency, and they just weren't. And look, I'm not saying Elway's Broncos weren't great in the late 90s. They were great teams. But, you know, you look back, even like the 49er team that dismantled the Chargers that year. I mean, you're looking at teams that were number one on offense, number two on defense, number one on defense, number three on offense. Now, you're looking at teams that are getting into the Super Bowl, they're like 19th on defense and 6th on offense. It's just not the same. But back then, you're having teams as the best offense and the best defense. People forget. You know, they talk about the triplets with the Cowboys. That 92 Super Bowl Cowboys team, they were the top defense in the league with Charles Haley and Tony Tolbert and Ken Norton Jr. I mean, you just don't have those complete teams anymore because of free agency. It's just the way it is.
And the cap.
Yeah, and the cap, obviously.
You know, and I will say this. I had a Twitter remark that somebody sent to me in the last 2 days, and he asked me, bless you, Dave, our producer Dave, taking a sneeze there.
He's trying to get the paint fumes out. It's okay.
Yeah, I'm I might be either passing out or higher than the clouds by the time we're done, John. One or the other. But the Twitter comment or question to me was, go back to the 80s Giants and think about Byron Hunt and Andy Hedden, who were backup outside linebackers to Lawrence Taylor. Okay? They were second and third string on the weak side to Lawrence, although Byron was able to play some strong side on occasion when he had to. And the question was, could those guys be starters on today's Giants team in 2016? And I said, absolutely. Especially Byron Hunt. There's no question. And he had trouble getting on the field at times. Andy hadn't, forget about it. He was third string.
And didn't they, and again, this is a little before my time, so correct me if I'm wrong, didn't like Pepper and Gary Reasons rotate too inside?
Pepper and Gary Reasons, and also Steve Diassi was a rotation guy on the inside when they were using the 3-4 defense.
Those are starters. They're starters.
No question.
But they didn't start.
I mean, you know, the game is so watered down because of the cap and free agency. But anyway.
Well, it's not watered down. It's just spread out. You have the same number of talented players. They're just spread out over more teams. I mean, that you go back to that Buck team. That was so bad in the late 90s. You had the 1-15 Cowboy team. I mean, there were some bad football teams.
I will tell you, what is John, you're familiar with the YouTube? Is it the YouTube deal that they just made with the NFL last week?
The YouTube. Paul, you're the best.
Right? Didn't they make a deal with the NFL?
It's just YouTube. It's not the YouTube.
But you know what I'm talking about.
Yes. On the internet.
And they ask the fans, right, to vote for the top three games in each team's history, and they're going to put them.
Oh, I didn't know about that, to be honest.
See? I'm telling you something, you young whippersnapper.
I'll make sure I check out the Twitter and the YouTube to learn about
this.
There
you go. And I believe, Dave, do you know about this? And the NFL is taking the fans' votes, and they're going to compile top three games for each team, and they're getting to watch them on the web.
But they're all going
to
be recent. These fans that are voting now don't know anything.
Well, for example, you don't think there are a lot of fans listening to us right now, and even maybe 20-something-year-olds who would like to watch the 86 Giants beat Denver in the Super Bowl and get a little bit of an idea of what Phil Simms was all about?
No, I think they're
that'd be pretty cool.
I think the smart and intelligent fans, which I believe are our listeners, and those types of fans, yeah, but I think there are too many dopey fans that say, I want to see Beckham's catch against the Cowboys.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, maybe.
Unfortunately, I think, look, I hope I'm wrong, but I have a funny feeling that's what's going to happen.
I don't know.
You know, like the Giants blowout win against the Vikings in the NFC Championship game in 2000. Who would want to rewatch that?
That's dominance.
Dismantling. Dismantling.
Yeah.
It's a great game.
Anyway.
By the way, we have some open lines, folks, if you want to jump on at 201-939-4513, 201-939-4513. Oh, so they picked the nominees. All right, so here are the five Giants nominees for that
contest.
Oh, they
narrowed it down already.
Apparently.
Okay,
what
do you got?
This is what Dave tells me. 1990 NFC Championship, 15-13 Giants.
I've got no problem with that one.
Super Bowl 42.
Okay.
Giants 17, Patriots 14.
Sure.
Great game. Get it, but it's recent. People have seen it. Now, this would be my vote because this is still my favorite game that I've ever been to in person. The 2007 NFC Championship game against the Packers.
Okay.
23-20. That game was fun. That was a fun game, man. The ups and downs with the missed field goals, the interception on Favre, all that stuff, man. That was a fun game.
Truth be told. That score does not reflect the way that game was played. The Giants dominated that game, and it never should have gone to overtime.
And then Super Bowl 25 and Super Bowl 21 are the other two. So you got the three.
All right.
So you have three out of the four Super Bowls. They do not have the 86 Super Bowl on there, believe it or not. It makes sense. It was kind of a blot.
But those are good picks.
No, those are good games. Those are great choices. Now, see, this is good. See, now I approve of the contest because you're narrowing it down, so you have better games to choose from.
Dave, do we know when those are available? When are they putting those up? Does it say?
Do you know when the vote's taking place? He's going to look it up for us.
Okay, that's good stuff.
In the meanwhile, let's go 201-939-4513. Adam in Columbus, Ohio. Adam, what's going on? Thanks for joining us on Big Blue Kickoff Live.
Hey, guys. How you doing? That might be the quickest wait period I've ever experienced on the show. So.
We got open lines, folks. Call in. Get on. This is your chance.
A lot of people on vacation.
Yeah.
I was wondering what you guys thought. I was reading a little bit on, you know, either Bleacher Report or some third-party site where they said that maybe Spagnuolo would like to kind of maybe mimic or replicate or put together another NASCAR package in pass rushing situations. And it kind of made me wonder, does that hurt help neither with respect to Nikita Whitlock's chances to maybe make the team? Could he maybe be utilized in that type of situation? I know they tried to manufacture some pass rush last year by using him there with limited success, if you will.
You know, here's the thing, Adam. I think Nikita Whitlock's really interesting because I know for a fact the coaches love him. The coaches think he's great. He does everything he's asked of. He switched positions last year, learned fullback. They use him as a pass rusher. But where they really love him is special teams. He's one of the top three, four special teams players on the team. That's how good he was on specials last year. So, unfortunately, I think, and I think Paul agrees with me, with the addition of Will Johnson, it's going to be really tough for Nikita to make the team as a fullback. So he's going to have to figure out a different way to get on this roster, whether, like you said, it's helping out in that pass, which I think is possible on third down. But I really think special teams is going to be one of the big deals for him if he finds a way onto this roster.
For me, it's going to be very, very, very hard for him to make the 50.
It's going to be hard. It's going to be hard.
I mean,
I agree.
Incredibly hard.
Mm-hmm.
The Giants need to find out who the depth is going to be at defensive tackle. You know, right now you got guys who are trying to fight for that, whether it's Bromley, Hughes, Nix. These guys are all fighting, you know, to be in that mixture of defensive tackle.
And can Owa be an emergency defensive tackle? More on pass rush. Who knows? He was such a good run stopper in college. Maybe he could be.
So, to me, the numbers ahead of Whitlock at the defensive tackle spot make it next to impossible for him to climb that mountain. And there is no question that Will Johnson was signed from the Steelers to be the starter here. Whether or not he's an H-back, a fullback, the inline tight end.
He's both. Whatever.
Will Johnson's playing.
Yeah.
They signed him to play. So he's not going to beat out Will Johnson.
Let me switch sides of the ball here and get a prediction then. The kid from Bowling Green, I remember when he was supposed to go to Ohio State.
Roger Lewis.
Columbus, and then he got in some trouble. Turns out that trouble never materialized into anything, but he had lost a scholarship by that time. What's anyone think of his chances to make the roster?
I think they're good.
I think he's got a good shot.
I think they're good.
Really?
He has a nice skill set. The Giants have been very happy with his attitude. And I will tell you right now, I think of the undrafted rookie free agents that are in this camp. Dante Dion was my number one dark horse, but he's not a dark horse because I think everybody liked him coming out of spring camp, so I don't know if I can call him a dark horse. But I have Roger Lewis as my number two guy, right behind Dante Dion, as potentially one of the three or four undrafted rookie free agents that makes this Giants team.
Three or four? Who are the others?
I think there's a possibility, I'm not going to say 100% for sure, that they also get another defensive lineman. Rose could be in that mix. Aguara could be in that mix.
How about Malik at tight end?
Malik at tight end could be in that mix. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's not out of the question that three or four could make it.
Well, that's interesting. I look forward to that. It's always nice to see the underdog get a chance, particularly when they succeed. So,
Even Milhouse at defensive tackle is trying to assert himself into that competition.
I'll tell you what, though, Adam. Wide receiver is going to be tough, and I think Roger Lewis does have a good shot. I think he showed a lot in the spring. But remember, Jeremy Davis was a draft pick last year, and he was very impressive in the spring. He caught everything that came his way.
Eli I got Manning him making it, John.
Had high praise for him. But then you got to be at the veteran Miles White, who I know Ben McAdoo has a lot of confidence in.
Miles White to me.
Are you going out for camp at all? I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, I think Miles White is practice squad eligible, which I think is interesting. He's one of those veterans who could sneak on there.
Now, I see where you're going.
I think the Giants are going to keep six wide receivers. And I've got Lewis and Jeremy Davis as 5 and 6. And I think Miles White, if he clears waivers, goes practice squad.
Are you then assuming Dwayne Harris?
Miles White. I'm sorry?
Are you assuming Dwayne Harris is
yes.
four then? Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Gotcha. Well, I appreciate the call, guys. We're flying in and hopefully catching camp on the last day on the 14th. If you guys are around, we'd love to stop by and see you, but looking forward to it.
We wouldn't be anywhere else, Adam. If you see a tan blur walking down the sideline, that's Paul Dottino. Just shout his name and he'll come right on over.
I'll certainly give him a shout. Thanks
a
lot.
Thanks,
guys.
Adam. Appreciate it. Let's go to another Adam. He's in New York. Wants to talk Olivier Vernon. Adam, what's up?
Hey, guys. How are you?
Doing great, Adam. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I'm one of those guys who actually does rewatch games. So if they put on the 1986 Giants on YouTube, I'd be front row with popcorn in my hand waiting to watch that team.
Well, Adam, you know what? I'm happy you asked, and I don't mean to cut you off, and I'll let you finish, but they apparently the voting's done. So that's already finished, so I can give you the winners. Not surprisingly, the young fans voted 59% for Giants-Patriots Super Bowl 42.
Okay.
So that's one. Game number two, the second most recent game, the NFC Championship game in 2007, Giants-Packers. And then game three, Paul, which one do you think they voted for the third one?
Wow. How about the other Super Bowl? The Bills won, 25.
What do you think, Adam? What do you think the third one was?
I'm going to say the third one was the NFC Championship game in 2011 against the 49ers.
That was, Paul is right, Super Bowl 25, wide right, Giants-Bills. That's number three. So that'll be up there sometime in August on YouTube.
Well, I will definitely watch any one of those games.
11% for that.
So, yeah. So, I mean, the 1990 Super Bowl, I didn't really get to watch. I was only six. So I didn't really get to see it, so I would love to see that in its entirety and that defense and that game plan that they implemented at that time with that offense.
Carl Banks was awesome in that game. Mark Collins beat the stuffing out of Andre Reed in that game. That's a great game.
And Adam, if I'm not mistaken, I think the NFL released some greatest games DVDs for each team, right, where they have some of the full games on there. Am I wrong about that?
I
thought they did. Maybe I'm wrong. I'll look that up for you. Go ahead, Adam.
And I just want to talk about Olivier Vernon. Obviously, I'm a highlights guy, so I've been watching a lot of stuff on Olivier Vernon. When we rewatched the Miami game just to scout him myself. And someone said, Jesse Armstead said, he has a great quick first step. And my God, that guy can get off the football. So I'm only bringing this up because NFL Network and other entities have said, you know, that he's an $85 million man. He's not going to be able to produce that contract number, and I have a feeling playing on opposite of side with JPP and having that first step that he has, I think he's going to produce a lot more than people think. I'm going to go out on a prediction and say he's going to have 10 sacks, 3 forced fumbles this year, at the very least 10 sacks. That's my prediction for him.
I think that's fair.
Obviously, he doesn't know defense that well yet. Because he's in a new system, but I'm thinking at the end of the year, remember, he's pretty happy with Olivier Vernon in that signing, and I think he's going to live up to that contract, because if you look at it right now, he's peaking at the right time. You know, he's been in the league for a couple of years already, right? He's had 11.5 sacks, 7.5 sacks. To me, now paired with JPP, paired with the mastermind that is Steve Spagnuolo, I think you can put him on a lot of places, and they're going to have stand up, they're going to have a rush from the end. I think this guy, only the sky's the limit in New York for him. I think people need to realize, like, yes, $85 million is a big price tag. But to think about it, I think he's going to produce. And one non-football thing I wanted to ask you guys
real
about.
Quick.
Von Miller, do you think he reminds you guys of Derek Thomas? And I'll listen off the air.
Yeah, a little bit. I think he does.
Thank you.
I think that's fair. I think I appreciate the call. Thanks a lot. I think very similar body type to Derek Thomas.
Well, is he talking body type or is he talking style of play?
Well, I mean, he's a pass rushing outside.
Derek Thomas, for all that I respect of what he was, is a tremendous pass rusher.
He didn't stop the run well.
Not at all.
No,
he didn't want to stop the run.
He ignored running plays. What did he weigh, 250 pounds, though?
Well,
he was a small guy.
Very slender.
Remember, they asked him to be a hand in the dirt pass rusher. Von Miller standing up in the 4-3 a lot of the time,
That's correct. They're playing a different position.
But I think their body types are very similar, though. Right?
Maybe Thomas was a little leaner.
You think
he looked like it?
A little more slender, you think, maybe?
He looked a little bit more wiry to me.
I can see that.
But he sold out on the run all the time. Simeon Rice was another guy, constantly sold out on the run. And it's like, really?
Absolutely.
Really? I mean, come on. And you want to be known as a great, great player? He had the nerve to criticize Strahan, one of the great run-stopping defensive ends in pass rushing history. And Simeon Rice, who just run? Please, I'm not even going to bother. Forget it.
Derek Thomas never talked any trash, though, or anything like that.
No.
He was fine. He was very respectful.
Right. Very respectful of him.
Very good guy.
Simeon Rice was a chatterbox.
And I want to go back to Vernon for a second. To me, it's a disappointment if he doesn't get to 10.
Thank you, John. That's what I was going to say. You saw it in my face.
I did.
I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute. For what the Giants have done to bring him here, and for the kind of guy that he is.
And for the guys around him.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you something. I'll be bummed if he doesn't get at least 12.
He's never gotten that much.
I know, but The expectations are high.
Well, don't they have to be?
And I think he has them too.
Oh, yeah, we aren't putting anything on Olivier Vernon that he doesn't already think. Because you know what? Because if you look at his sack numbers last year, just 7.5. But if you look at all, like, the peripheral pass rush stats, near the top of the league. So if he can just convert a small percentage of those hurries and knockdowns and hits and all that stuff into sacks, you're looking at 12 or 13.
Look at it this way. JPP had 16.5 a few years ago when he was in the Pro Bowl, right?
Yep.
I really believe if the Giants are going to be really good, I mean, if they're going to be a really good, solid playoff team, you're probably going to see Vernon and JPP combined for nearly 25 sacks.
I think that's a good target.
I don't know that it's realistic. They may combine for 20.
Right. But, I think that's also realistic.
But if they combine for 25, the Giants are probably winning this division.
I think that's a good range, 20 to 25 for those two together. All right, final call of the show. Len is in Columbia, Maryland. Len, how was your 2 weeks off?
Well, Paul and I talked about it yesterday.
Ah.
Look, great show today. I'm talking about some of those important games. Let me, if you can give me 1 minute, I want to narrow the list down to what I consider franchise-changing Giants wins in the regular season.
Ooh, okay. I like it.
Franchise. Woo. This is, and Paul will probably agree with this. These are franchise-changing wins. I'm going to take you back to 1958, last game of the season. Pat Summerall kicks a field goal against
the
Cleveland Browns
in
Game 12 to create, for the first time in NFL history,
I remember that,
a playoff game that is followed by that magnificent overtime game against the Colts. That win that Sunday jump-started the NFL toward where it is today. A wonderful win. Paul, you'll remember the 81 game, last game of the season against the Cowboys, that Saturday, that field goal put us in the playoffs for the first time, fill in the playoffs for the first time. A wonderful regular season win. Paul, you and I talked about 86 down here against the Redskins. Just an unbelievable win that just put Phil in a Super Bowl for the first time. I mean, without that win, we don't get started on the Super Bowl. Now, remember, I'm sticking with regular season wins, and then I'm going to add to that 2007 game in Buffalo, and Bradshaw running down the sidelines, a touchdown that put us in the playoffs, and Eli on our way to the Super Bowl in 2007. Just four, to me, franchise-changing. If you ask Mr. Mara, I think he'd say, boy, those are four or five regular season wins that just catapulted the Giants into great favor and the NFL into great favor.
Len, I want to throw one other one at you, and this is more recent. I mean, I think you got to look at the Jason Pierre-Paul block field goal game against the Cowboys in 2011.
Wow. Big one. No question. But those are the ones that stand out to me. If we wanted to add one to the playoff facts, remember all the ones that the NFL had list on their list were indeed playoff games. I was trying to stay with regular season games that I thought were really important in the history of the Giants. But let me add one championship game, and I'm going to go back even further. And, John, you know what my email address is. It's got the number 56 in it.
Yeah.
And if I'm talking to people who are Paul's age and my age, although I'm a little older, the 56 stands for that win over the Bears, the first world championship that I remember the Giants winning in 56. If we're John, if we're your age, the 56 stands for Lawrence Taylor. So depends who I'm talking to. But that 56 championship win, that was the first one in a long, long, long time for the Giants, and I'll never forget it because that was my first.
Len, I love to reminisce. I love to reminisce with guys like yourself, and I want to throw out a game to you, which personally for me is incredibly significant, and nobody would ever think about it in a billion years. But I want to throw it out there, and I think you're a good enough fan that you're going to remember it really, really well. And I've talked to players years after this game, and I've told them right to their faces. I was 17 years old in 1981, and as you know, the Giants had gone through a really bad drought all those years, 16 years without the playoffs. And in 81, the Giants went down to Atlanta Fulton County Stadium. William Andrews, Steve Bartkowski and company, those Falcons, they were really good. That was the heyday of the Atlanta Falcons at that time. That was a really good addition of the Falcons. They were playoff teams. The Giants go down and beat them in the pouring rain in Atlanta Fulton County Stadium, where Joe DiNello kicks a field goal. The final score, and I'm looking at it here, was 27-24. DiNello beats them in overtime. That game put the Giants at 5-3 at the midpoint of that season, and it was the first time in my life as a 17-year-old teenager.
16-game schedule that year?
Yeah.
The 16? Okay.
It was the first time that I truly believed the Giants had a chance to be a playoff team.
Okay.
Because
I like that.
They had knocked off a very strong Falcons team who a lot of people thought were actually Super Bowl contenders in their building, in the pouring rain, in overtime, and remember, that was LT's rookie season.
Right.
And
yep.
It was like,
yes, it was.
We've got Superman now. We just beat this team. We're 5-3. I think the Giants, we could actually utter P, the playoff word. The Giants could be a playoff team. It's the first time in my life that I thought that it was really possible.
That's a good one.
And they did.
Put it on the list. I remember that game. Put it on that list. I think you're absolutely right. And, Paul, there's nothing like that feeling when it suddenly hits you. Oh, my gosh.
I know.
We got a pretty good football team here, and we're on our way.
Thank you, Len. We got to run.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. You know the regular season game I like, too? And, unfortunately, the season didn't end the way you would want it to. That regular season finale against the Panthers when they ran for the 300 yards on the ground with Derek Ward overtime. That was a hell of a game too.
Look, when you've been around as long as I have, you've seen so many,
sure.
And so many you forget as well. But there are just some that stick out for some reason, and sometimes it's just a weird reason,
right?
And it's like, no, that's an important landmark game for me. Mm-hmm. That 81 Falcons game is, and it's weird because they wound up going on a 3-game losing streak after that to go under 500 at 5-6.
Wow.
But then did what they had to do the last few weeks of the year, went 9-7 and made the playoffs and then beat Philadelphia at the old Vet in the first round.
Different sport, but it reminds me of this. In 1995, late September, the Yankees hadn't made the playoffs in forever. Not from what I can remember in my lifetime, being born in 81. And they played a game against the Toronto Blue Jays in late September. And Scott Kamenicki,
wow,
of all people, went out there and threw like a 8-inning gem. Pat Kelly, I think, hit a big home run in that game. And that got to the Yankees to the playoffs for the first, helped them get into the playoffs for the first time in 95. They eventually would go on. They lost to the Mariners, obviously, in five games in the ALDS. I think that was the first year they actually had the ALDS, if I remember properly.
Yeah,
I think it was only two series before then. And that was one of the Yankee regular season games where that was like, you know what? Maybe this team really has got something.
There are landmark games that you just remember for whatever the reason may be. And you remember, John, as a kid growing up, you know, whenever you root for your favorite team, if your team has gone through a drought and you don't know what it's like to have a playoff game.
Well, I was thinking, like, growing up in New York with the Giants were good growing up for me. You know what I mean?
Right.
86, they were really good. They obviously – I remember my dad went to that Super Bowl in 86, and I remember he came home with, like, the Super Bowl pennant.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of all I remember from 86. I was only 5 years old. But I remember that – that's how I remember that game. And I remember watching and the Bill game, Super Bowl, obviously. I was you know, 9. But I remember that vividly. Nord missing that kick.
To understand a little bit about perspective, and I'll make this very quick because I know we're running out of time. The end of the 1970 season, the Giants are playing the Rams at Yankee Stadium, and if they win the game, they're going to be a wild card team in the NFC because they had just merged the AFL and NFL into the NFC and AFC. The Giants were 9-4, and they needed to win this game to be a playoff team. They take a 3-0 lead on a Gogolak field goal. They're up 3-0. And then they give up 31 straight points to the Rams. Tarkenton gets crushed. I think he turned it over 3 or 4 times. The fearsome foursome beat the stuffing out of them. Roman Gabriel was hotter than a flame in an oven. And it's 31-3. The Giants lose. And I'm listening to my little Panasonic portable radio as Marty Glickman's counting down the final minute of the game. And the Giants finish 9-5 and do not make the playoffs. And it was from that moment on that I said, okay, well, hopefully someday. And then it was years and years and years and years later until Lawrence Taylor.
That's why when everybody always says there's always next year, oh, you're close. You never know what's going to happen. I mean, look at the Mets. You know, the Mets last year in the World Series, all of a sudden Matt Harvey out for the year, Syndergaard tired arm, Matt's, you know, elbow. You know, you just never know what's going to happen.
Don't take it for granted, John.
Never take it for granted because you don't never know what's going to happen. By the way, I mentioned this and I looked it up. I'm not sure it's on the Giants Pro Shop. Go to the Giants Team Shop on Giants.com. But if you can't find it, there on Amazon.com. There is a New York Giants 10 Greatest Games DVD with 10 full games on it.
No kidding.
It has the 86, Giants 49, Niners 3, 86 Giants 17, Redskins 0, 86 Super Bowl, 90-31-3 over the Bears, 15-13 over the Niners, then the Super Bowl, 2000 Giants 20, Eagles 10. That was a fun game. They also have the NFC Championship from that year, 41-zip. And then you have the big comeback in 2006, Giants 30, Eagles 24.
Wow.
And then they have the 2007 Super Bowl, Giants 17, Patriots
And these
14.
Are full games.
Full games.
Wow.
Full games.
Good stuff.
So,
I actually have a lot of those,
I'm sure you do. On VHS. So I'm sure if there are Giant fans out there that want some better resolution or whatever, and you want to go out there, you can Google search that DVD. It's still available out there online if you want to check that out. All right, folks, that's it for Big Blue Kickoff Live on Giants.com. Marks and Meadow tomorrow, they'll preview Giants-Bengals, which I guess is apropos given that the Ring of Honor just got announced, and that's the game that the guys will be going up there.
Indeed.
So they will preview that game. And then on Thursday, we're doing a pre-recorded show. It will not be live. So we're going to have three guests. We're going to preview the Bears and the Browns. And also, I guess I could tease it now, a very special guest will be joined by former Giants general manager Ernie Accorsi for the show on Thursday, who's going into the Ring of Honor. So Lance and I will have that for you. Again, we're going to tape it tomorrow, but we'll have that show up at noon on Thursday. So we won't take your calls on Thursday, but you'll have three great interviews. Make sure you check that out. For Paul Dottino, I'm John Trone. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you tomorrow on Giants.com, everybody. Have a great day.